Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Telerik. Create compelling app experiences across any screen with the Telerik platform. Telerik's end-to-end platform uniquely combines industry-leading UI tools with cloud services to simplify the entire app development cycle. Telerik offers everything .NET developers need to build quality apps faster. Try it free at telerik.com/platform. That's telerik.com/platform.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 451. In this episode, Scott talks with graphic novelist, software engineer, and Eisner Award winner Gene Yang about computers, creativity, and comics.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes. And today I'm talking with Gene Yang. He is an author and a writer and a computer science teacher. How are you?
Good. Thank you for having me. It's exciting to be here.
No, it is absolutely my pleasure. It's funny, when you reached out to talk to me about your book that you're working on, you were very kind. You introduced yourself and told me about your stuff. And I knew all about you already because I was fan of your book and perhaps your most famous book, American Born Chinese.
Yeah, American Born Chinese came out in 2006. Now, when I started that book, I'd been doing comics for about 5 years, but American Born Chinese was really the life changer. It's the reception of that book was well beyond anything I'd imagined possible, and it really changed things for me.
Is this one of those examples of an overnight success in a half a decade?
Yeah, I guess so. Actually, you know, because I had been doing comics for 5 years when I started American Born Chinese. It took me 5 years to do that book. So by the time it came out, I'd been in comics for like 10 years.
It had been a
full decade before that book came out.
When that book came out, was it something where it happened organically? Because I wonder sometimes, like, are there press people telling everyone about your book? Or is this one of those things where word of mouth happened?
You know, I am not totally sure. So American Born Chinese was the very first book that was published by my current publisher, First Second Books, which is a subset of Macmillan. It's like an imprint of Macmillan, one of the major book publishers in the world. And they are very connected to these three different markets for comics. So comics traditionally in America have always been sold through comic book stores. And then within the last couple decades, they've started getting sold in regular bookstores and also to the library market. So because of where First Second sits within the marketplace, they have connections to the comic book stores, to the regular bookstores, and to the library market. And I think that really helped me. I think that helped me tremendously.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I've noticed it's fairly obvious, but in the themes of your book and in the cover art, there's this sense of the, and people will see this, they can look in the show notes. You see half of the protagonist's face. One of the covers for American Born Chinese, you just see the one side of the person's face. In another two-book series, Boxers and Saints, you see the half of their face. What's going on there?
Yeah, I have to be honest, that was not my decision. I did work with a designer on those book covers, but I am a terrible designer. You know, I think I'm okay at cartooning. I am terrible as a graphic designer. So for American Born Chinese, I worked with this very talented designer named Danica Novgorodov, who's also a cartoonist herself. She can do both, whereas I can't. And it was her idea to do half the face. And I think the idea behind that was the book is really about a negotiation of identities and for a lot of immigrants' kids, it's about taking two halves of yourself and trying to mesh them together, especially when those two halves don't always fit together well, you know?
Yeah.
And for Boxers and Saints, because American Born Chinese had been so well received, the idea behind that book was to have some kind of a recall to American Born Chinese so people could see it and tell that it was from the same author. The woman who designed that book is named Colleen A.F. Venable, and she's both Danica and Colleen are absolutely amazing designers. I was very lucky to have them on my project.
Yeah, it's a very evocative way of expressing what's going on here. You know, it makes it really clear that this is a story about, about really like kind of the number two. There's multiple, there's two tails, there's the second generation, there's two halves, you know. It was very dramatic in Boxers and Saints, and you were kind enough to send me a copy that I've been sharing with my sons.
Well, thank you for reading it.
Yeah, absolutely. The Boxers and Saints tells two sides of the Boxer Rebellion during the Qing Dynasty, and I noticed that you started to explore historical themes in order to kind of better understand yourself, it seems.
Like, I think so. I mean, I first got interested in the Boxer Rebellion in the year 2000. That year, Pope John Paul II canonized a group of Chinese Catholic saints. Mm. And I grew up in this Chinese American Catholic community in the Bay Area, in the San Francisco Bay Area. My home church flipped out about this because this is the first time, you know, that the Roman Catholic Church, this deeply Western institution, had acknowledged Chinese citizens in this way. Mm-hmm. And when I looked into the lives of these canonized saints, I discovered that many of them were martyred during the Boxer Rebellion, during this war, you know, that was fought over 100 years ago in China. And I barely remembered about the Boxer Rebellion from high school history. You know, I remember just bits and pieces. And I think that's true for most American students. We don't hear much about the Boxer Rebellion. But the more I studied this war, the more I realized that it really embodied this tension between Eastern and Western ways of being and thinking that I felt in my own life as an Asian American. And that's what I just think that all of my projects are kind of ways of exploring my own neuroses or the tensions within my own life. That maybe, I think that's probably true for every artist, you know? That's part of the reason why we do art. It's like self-therapy.
Yeah, I think every good artist is neurotic, and that drives them. And it's also, but it's also a sense of self-exploration.
Yeah, it is. It's like you're working something out.
Yeah, what exactly am I doing here? And it's interesting that this is a Chinese, that the Catholicism versus the kind of traditional Chinese, that there's a duality there. Yeah. There's the immigrant story. You know, being, how can you be fully 100% American and fully 100% Chinese at the same time?
Yeah. I think that is. I also think, you know, in the modern world, this tension between identities is becoming more and more of a thing, not just for immigrant kids, mm-hmm. But just in general, I think computer technology and social media have really introduced this idea. You know, most of us have at least two identities. We have the identity that we are when we interact with people face to face. And then we have this other identity that is often separate that we maintain online.
And unfortunately, I feel like these days, people are forgetting who they are because they are so focused on trying to be someone else. Whether it be Facebook likes or someone told me about this very, not neurotic isn't the word, but it's very narcissistic idea of, you know, I've gone to the top of the mountain. I'm at the top of the Himalayas, selfie.
Yeah.
And then, you know, hashtag peaceful.
Yeah.
And it's just like, wow, what a horrible way to be. How do we teach our kids about the past and not focusing on that kind of quick.
Yeah, I have to tell you, I agree that it's horrible, but I also deeply feel that temptation. You know, I think I have to force myself these days to be present in my body as opposed to just in my mind and in the screen. I've noticed when I hang out with my kids, you know, sometimes I'll like have the impulse to take a picture of them as opposed to just look at them with my own two eyes. Mm. It's kind of a thing. It's kind of a thing that I struggle with nowadays.
Yeah, that is a challenge. And I think it is only going to continue the more computerized the things get. And you probably see this because now, even though you are a successful and very well thought of artist and writer, you are still teaching high school. Is that true?
I am. I teach at Bishop O'Dowd High School, which is a Catholic school in Oakland, California. Mm-hmm. I've been there since 1998. So I've been there forever. I've been there a long, long time. I started off as a full-time teacher. I've taught mostly computer science there. I've taught a little bit of math and a little bit of art, but mostly computer science. And nowadays I'm down to just one class. I have one class of introductory computer science. I used to also teach the AP class, but as my life has gotten busy, I've had to give that up.
So you've got an interesting perspective, kind of if historically. You've been doing this now. How many years is that? 16 years?
It's like, it's a long time. 16, 17 years.
Yeah.
So it's been kind of crazy. Yeah. When I started teaching, I was teaching Pascal. Remember Pascal?
I loved Pascal. Was it Turbo Pascal or Delphi?
It was, I think it was Turbo. It was, I only did it for a year. Did it for a year. And then, we switched over to C++. I did that for a number of years and now we're on Java.
And so you've got an interesting historical context because you've watched a bunch of different high schoolers change technologies. You've watched the technology world change. You've watched the rise of social media. You could probably tell, you know, what was a 15-year-old like in 98 versus a 15-year-old today? Very different concerns.
Yeah, it really is. One of the big differences I've noticed with my students is their desire to drive. You know, when I first got there, the kids were like me when I was a teenager. They desperately wanted their driver's licenses. And now I feel like that desire has kind of evaporated. And I wonder if, like most of my students now, they don't mind not getting their driver's licenses as soon as they turn 16. You know, some of them don't ever want it ever. And I wonder if that has something to do with the internet and how available things become through the internet for us. Back in the day, if I wanted comic books, I had to drive to the comic book store. Nowadays, I can just download a comic book from Comixology.
Yeah, that you know, it's interesting. You're now the second person in 2 weeks to say that. And the first person said that, I was like, no, that can't be right. And now it's been confirmed scientifically because you've said it.
Because there are two people. Yeah.
Because two people have said it. So it's it's a thing. And that's really true. All I wanted to do in the late 80s was drive because it meant being anywhere but here.
Yeah. And it's a freedom. But I feel like maybe the internet gives us that same sort of freedom as driving used to.
And I used to drive to the comic book store and I used to have a box at the comic book store.
That's right. A pull list.
I had a pull list. Too.
That's right.
Now you're working on a new book. I understand that you're just getting started and it's going to be a while before this comes out. It's called Secret Coders.
It'll be out next September. And the way the book world works is you finish a book and then almost a year later, it'll come out. So, I finished writing it. I'm working with this amazing cartoonist named Mike Holmes. So I have some books where I do both the writing and the drawing. This is a project where I'm only doing the writing and Mike is doing the drawing. He's probably most well known for, his work on Bravest Warriors. Have you ever seen that show?
Yeah.
There's a comic that goes along with it, and Mike was the primary illustrator on that comic for a while.
No,
but
that's
great.
Was,
he's awesome.
Bravest Warriors was a three seasons of Bravest Warriors?
I think so. It was created by the same guy who did Adventure Time.
Pendleton Ward.
Yeah, that's right. And Mike worked with Pendleton on this comic. But he's phenomenal. He's phenomenal. Secret Coders kind of represents the coming together of my two worlds. I began drawing comics and I began programming both in the fifth grade, you know, and then in college, I majored in computer science and I minored in creative writing. My creative writing minor was all about eventually writing comic books. And all the way through, I've always wanted to bring these two things together, but they never quite fit until now. So Secret Coders is a series of graphic novels meant for middle school kids in fifth, sixth, seventh grade, all about coding. And the way we're pitching it is we're saying that it's a lot like Harry Potter. You know, in Harry Potter, a bunch of tween kids find this secret school that teaches them magic. Mm-hmm. So in our story, a bunch of tween kids find the secret school, but the secret school, instead of teaching magic, teaches coding. And we're hoping that as the readers follow our protagonists through their journey into becoming coders, that they themselves will become coders as well.
I've always thought that people who never learn to code, whether they be, you know, I don't know if you have this situation where maybe your neighbors aren't 100% sure what you do, but they know that you're kind of a nerd. So you may be at like the local homeowners association and then you'll have a conversation with someone you've just met and they'll go, Oh, you're a computer person. And then immediately you've become other.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of like, well, you know, Gene knows the mysteries of secret coding and I'll never be one of those people. And they've simultaneously set you apart, but they've also basically disempowered themselves because they've just declared that they'll never be a programmer. They'll never understand computers.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And what they don't realize is that the building blocks of coding are very, very simple. You know, it's really all about building these incredibly complex things with very simple pieces. I firmly believe, I don't believe that everybody should be a professional coder, but I do believe that every single human being ought to learn a little bit of coding sometime during their education. I just think it's no matter what you do as an adult, you are going to come into contact with coders. You know, you're going to have to learn to communicate with coders, and having a basic understanding of that discipline is just so important.
Right. And it's not, you know, necessarily going out to the command prompt. I think it's for loops and it's the basics. It might be an Excel macro.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Just mastering those three basic control structures and figuring out how to, I mean, it's really about logic, right? And I think when I was in fifth grade and I first learned coding, it was in Logo. You remember Logo?
Yeah. I learned on Apple too. I think you and I are the same age.
Yeah, that's right. I learned it on Apple II as well. And that's actually the language that, that they learn in Secret Coders too. I'm using Logo, not just because I have a deep, you know, pre-logical love of it, but also because nowadays it has this weird ancient mystique to it. You know, it's kind of slightly forgotten.
You just said we were ancient.
Yeah. We kind of are though. We kind of are, especially in computer years. We absolutely are ancient. Yeah. But what fascinated me about Logo is it was like magic. You take these very simple commands and you get a picture out of it, mm-hmm. you know, and there's something magic about translating words into something visual or into something that's active.
I don't know if you had this in your Logo class, but in the 80s when I was doing that, just like we have Arduinos and robot kits, you know, today they would give us a big giant long 25-pin ribbon cable that was probably, oh gosh, you know, 10, 15 feet long. And we would plug in a robot and a Sharpie and we would take our Logo and we'd drive it around on a piece of butcher paper. And really the only thing that's changed in 25 years is Bluetooth and Wi-Fi. But it's fundamentally the same idea is there.
Yeah, I was not lucky enough to have a mechanical turtle. The turtles that I used were all on screen.
All on screen?
Yeah, yeah. But I saw pictures. You know, they had photos of the mechanical turtles in our textbooks, and I was always very jealous of the kids that got
well,
to play with
them. Well, we only had the one, and we were told to be very careful. We also only had the one Apple II as well.
Yeah.
One of the things that I think is an interesting parallel, you pointed out that Secret Coders is kind of like Harry Potter, is I feel that it's these themes of growing up and feeling disempowered. I mean, Harry started out feeling like all power was taken away from him. His adoptive parents took all his power away.
Yeah.
And then he discovered his power.
Yeah. Yeah. What I tell my students is that, you know, often the best coders are, people who are kind of control freaks. Because when you're knee deep in a program, you have full control over it. You have control over the design and the execution. And there's something very empowering about that. I see that with my students as well. I think coding has a way of bringing out a certain aspect of personality with some of my students. Some of my students who are very quiet, who may not necessarily feel engaged in their other subjects, when they sit down in front of a computer, when they're in this environment where they have full control, it really brings out something in them. And it's great to see. It's really empowering to see. There's that programmer's high that you get, right? When you crack a program, when you figure out a very elegant way of solving a problem, you get this little rush. And that's what I like to see as a teacher in my students.
Yeah, I get a little frustrated sometimes when I meet kids that I feel like if you would just listen, maybe this is for you, but they've already decided at some point in their growing up that, no, I'm not a computer person. Like, we've already determined this at age 8 or age 9. It's the whole kind of math is hard myth. The first time a kid says that, you've got a couple of minutes to get in there and say, no, we can make this fun for you. But if they've internalized that tape and started replaying it, then they'll never get back.
Then it's kind of hard. And I think what they don't realize is there are lots of different ways of being a computer person. There's not just one way, you know. There's hardware, there's software, there's, I mean, you can be a computer person and only be into Photoshop. Photoshop is such a deep tool, you know, and there's so many ways of applying a programmer's mindset to what you do in Photoshop. And the same can be said of almost any other application out there. There's lots of ways of being a computer person.
I think you just totally opened my mind there for a second, because it's one of those amazing and obvious statements that you just said. Like, you could be a computer person, you could be a programmer, and the app that you program is Photoshop. Because you can make in Photoshop, you know, effects that are layered on top of each other. You can program them and then build and then hand them to someone and say, here's my effects pack.
or even simply building actions within Photoshop.
And that's, distributing actions.
Yeah,
like that's right. I actually, for this podcast, when we're done, I will ask you for a headshot that I'll put on the website, and then I will run an Instagramify action in Photoshop that I didn't write.
That's right.
Even though I've been programming for 20 years, I have no idea how it works.
And it doesn't matter. It's a black box to you.
It's magic.
Yeah, that's right.
It's magic. But it is going to give me a level of power that I did not have before I learned how to do actions in Photoshop. So you said that you are teaching only a class now. Is that something that you're going to give up, or are you hanging on to that last class because you don't want to give it up?
I love education. You know, I think I'm just as much of a teacher as I am a cartoonist, if not more so. Mm-hmm. So I hope to be involved in education for as long as I can, you know, for all of my career.
Yeah.
That could change. That the format of that could change, but I hope to be involved, at least in some way. The programming class isn't the only place where I teach. I also teach creative writing through Hamline University, which is based out of Minnesota. I teach through their online program. It's an MFA program focusing on writing for children and young adults. So most of the faculty are novelists and poets and picture book writers. I'm the only comic book guy.
Mm-hmm.
But I've been doing that for 3 years. Most of my teaching there is online, and it's been amazing.
Do you think you would self-identify primarily as a teacher?
Maybe. I guess it depends on who I'm talking to, you know? I guess when I fill out legal forms, I always write down I'm a teacher. I think writing down that I'm a cartoonist is a little bit harder to explain.
I think that would be pretty cool to be able to say to the IRS, you know, job cartoonist.
And yeah, that's
just
right.
A way of sticking it to the
And
man.
There are people who do that. There are people who do that.
Yeah, I kind of came to terms with this idea that I was a teacher, and I went and updated my resume and all that kind of stuff a couple of years back because, well, people see me as a programmer. Ultimately, whether I am actively teaching, I either wish I was teaching, you know, hope I was teaching, aim to teach at some point in the future, or in everything that I do, there should be an element of teaching.
Yeah, I think I see that with what you're doing with this podcast and with your blog. I think there's definitely a teaching element to all that.
Yeah, I definitely felt like, particularly the book, Boxers and Saints, while my wife was, felt it was a little violent for the kids. My kids are 7 and 9.
Ooh, okay.
Well, we skipped over a few beheadings. But,
yeah.
What was interesting about it was it really started to bring up a conversation with my 9-year-old, particularly about fiction versus nonfiction, because he had decided in his mind that fiction was the only good thing in the world because it was, you know, kind of infinitely interesting and you could always do things. But he didn't really get a sense of the scope of the past. So then we started talking about the Boxer Rebellion and how long ago it was and how this was a fictional story about a nonfiction thing.
Yeah.
That duality was really interesting, and it got him very interested in history.
Oh, good. That's great. That's great. I have a son. He's 11 now, but he was 9 when I finished the book, and I didn't let him read it because of the violence, but he snuck it away from me, you know?
Yeah.
I had my proof sitting on my desk, and he just snuck the whole thing away from me. He read the whole thing. He's like, Dad, it's not that bad. What's wrong? But I, you know, historical fiction is something that I'm very interested in nowadays. Mm-hmm. And I think it really can serve as this on-ramp to just plain old nonfiction. Which is also something, I think most of my reading nowadays is in nonfiction, but I think that's something very important for kids to realize, is that often the best stories actually happen. They actually happened in the past.
Yeah, I think that that's so important for kids to understand that historical context. And I have tried to apply that in everything that I do. You were saying how you taught Pascal for a while there. Maybe you don't teach it anymore, but I'll suspect that when you do talk about computer science, from what I've learned about you today, you probably talk about the historical context and, you know, see an assembler come up and like, well, why did they do that in the 60s? And
yeah, we do talk a little bit about that. About, like, in my introduction to Java, we talk about what the reasoning behind the Java virtual machine is and what problem that was supposed to solve.
Yeah,
I don't know how well that goes across with the students, but
well, isn't that funny? Like, when you do end up talking to kids about the, you know, the history, their eyes kind of glaze over. But I've always had this theory that if I can just get that one or that two, like I'll be in a room of 30 kids. I do an exploring engineering class at the local community college, and I just keep looking for a face to light up. Cause even though I'm not going to get all 30 of them, he got it. Oh, she got it.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Now I'm going to look at you two because something just clicked and you're going to go home and take apart your toaster.
Yeah, that's right. That's the teacher's high right there. That little click is the teacher's high. You know, now I'm talking to you, I wonder if I should put my discussion on the Java virtual machine a little bit further back, because I wonder if I think what interests us is when we talk about history in relation to ourselves, you know, mm-hmm. and the Java virtual machine and the problem that that's supposed to solve. That's something that maybe you need to experience as a coder before mm-hmm. you can really appreciate what Sun was trying to do.
Well, I've always believed that when teaching, there needs to be an element of suffering, not capital S
suffering. That's a great, great way of putting it.
You know, before, like, I'll give you a couple of examples that I use in my class. My son wants a digital watch. You can't have a digital watch until you learn to do an analog watch, because you're going to suffer first. And then I will tell you what a digital watch works. When he learns how to drive, presuming he does want to learn how to drive, uh-huh. he will drive a stick.
Ooh,
because
there you go.
You've got to drive a stick because you learn how the car works. Otherwise, you're going to be, and I always make my dad said, otherwise, someone's going to break their leg. You're going to have to drive them to the hospital. The only car available is a stick. Yeah. He's going to lose his leg.
that's great. I have to tell you, I learned on an automatic. My wife taught me how to drive a stick.
And that's good. I'm glad that you finally learned how to do that. and I think that, you know, if you're going to get memory management and a virtual machine, well, you need to first tidy up your own memory, you know. Before we get someone to clean your room, you need to clean your own room.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
I like to say that we are abstracting on the shoulders of giants.
Yeah, that's a great way of putting it too. I think that knowledge is kind of just built that way, right? Everything that you know, everything that you come up with is built on the work of somebody else. And I feel like that's true of programmers and cartoonists. The mm-hmm. the language that we use in modern cartooning is built on things that people invented a century ago.
Do you explore that? Wasn't there a book about cartooning? It was it's kind of like considered like the book about the language.
Understanding Comics.
Understanding Comics.
Yeah, by Scott McCloud. That book I read when I was just finishing up my teenage years. And I feel like if I did not read that book, mm-hmm. I would not be drawing comics today. That book blew my mind.
Yeah, I kind of suspected as much, because there's elements that I wouldn't say tropes, because that's trope is become a negative word, uh-huh. but there are thematic and dramatic elements in how you use white space and the edge of the frame. And I'm assuming this is a collaboration with you and whatever artist that you're working with on uh-huh. the book that you're working on. 'Cause there's an evocative sense of like, this is what this frame needs to make the person feel.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And you're drawing on an established, language, right? So, We've had over a century of modern cartooning and what word balloons mean, what certain fonts mean, what certain colors mean, all of that is sort of an established tradition. So when I make a comic, I am both trying to respect things that have come before me and hopefully maybe pushing into some new territory as well. I think that's true of any modern cartoonist. Understanding Comics by Scott McCloud. Scott McCloud is like, I feel like for him, he sort of sits in that in-between space too, between computers or technology and comics. His dad was a physicist, and he has a very, very technical mind. Scott has a very technical mind. He approaches comics in this very technical way, which I think really appealed to me too, as a computer nerd and a comic book nerd.
Do you think that what he's done with exploring comics is he's pulled out all of the kind of the essence of it? He's nailed it down to like, this is modern 20th century comics
or he's begun the discussion on it. I think that, you know, in the same way that a language a programming language is defined by these very, very basic commands, and that's what he did. He came up with the very basic commands that make up the comics language.
Right. I think that, I don't know if this is a weak parallel, but I also think about like how when Joseph Campbell kind of pulled out the hero's journey, and then you say, look at Star Wars. This is the Greek mythology here. Here is the hero's journey. And this is, again, the word trope gets overused, but these are the tools that we use to tell a compelling narrative.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's exactly that. And I think that that's maybe why that's one of the things that attracts me to both of these disciplines, to both comics and coding, is that in both of these disciplines, you take very simple pieces and you can build very, very complex things with them. To the point where when you're looking at the final complexity, it's very difficult to see the simple pieces underneath, right? That's something magic.
Do you think that comics, and also people say graphic novels, is a way of somehow like legitimizing comics?
Yeah.
You know, what do you say to a parent who might be listening who's like, you know, I don't really want my kid reading X-Men. I mean, this is not really a legitimate art form. This is not a book.
Well, I have to say that that graphic novel, the term, it's a very clunky term. It's not awesome. Because no, a lot awesome. Of the things that we call graphic novels these days are not actually novels. We call collections of short stories told in comics form graphic novels. We call nonfiction comics graphic novels. But at the same time, that term graphic novel has done its job. The legend is that it was come up with by a guy named Will Eisner, a mm-hmm. cartoonist who did a strip called The Spirit in the 1940s. Will Eisner is incredibly, incredibly influential within American comics. He's one of the first guys to bring cinematic storytelling techniques into American comics. In the 1970s, he came up with these short stories that were based on his own childhood. He grew up in this Jewish neighborhood in New York. And when he tried to sell it, he would tell publishers, you know, I have this collection of short stories about these Jewish kids, and it's told in comic format, and nobody wanted it. And then he started saying, you know, I have this graphic novel about these Jewish kids growing up in New York, and he was able to pick up a publisher. So from the beginning, graphic novels has been this way of separating comics from like the biases and the stereotypes that the American audience has of the medium.
And Will Eisner is who the Eisner Award was named for. And in fact, American Born Chinese, if I remember correctly, won the Eisner Award.
Yeah, that's right. It was a crazy night. It was a crazy night. I got to shake Neil Gaiman's hand. He was the one that presented it to me. It was awesome.
That's amazing.
Yeah. It was pretty amazing. It was pretty amazing.
So people can go to GeneYang.com. They can learn about your comics, events. You do go to Comic-Con sometimes. People can meet you.
I go almost every year. That's right.
That's very exciting. And people may see you in places that they might not expect. Like, for example, you did the comics continuation of the Nickelodeon cartoon Avatar. So if your kids love Avatar, this could be an on-ramp into the world of Gene Yang.
Have you seen that show, Avatar Last Airbender?
My kids love it. They're absolutely obsessed.
Yeah, it's been a thrill to work on that. I was just a fan when the show was airing on Nickelodeon. I was just a fan, mm-hmm. you know, and I remember the very last episode, Zuko confronts his dad and goes, "What happened to my mother?" And then the scene cuts and I freaked out like, "Why don't you tell us?" And to think that, you know, 3 years later, I'm part of the team that's answering that question. It's been really amazing.
That's amazing. Folks can also keep an eye out for Secret Coders. It's coming out next year. And if you'll come back on the show closer to the release in September of 2015, I would love to have you back.
I would love to be back. Thank you, Scott.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.